Looking to connect with the brightest minds in tech transfer and innovation? Then don't miss your chance to advertise right here on Autumn on the Air. With a highly engaged audience of academic, government, and industry professionals, your message will be heard by the very people shaping the future of research commercialization. Whether you're launching a new product, building brand awareness, or recruiting top talent, the Autumn Podcast is where your message belongs. Contact info@autumn.net today to learn more.
You're listening to Autumn on the Air, the weekly podcast that brings you conversations about the impact of research commercialization and the people who make it happen. Join us for interviews with patent and licensing professionals, innovators, entrepreneurs, and tech transfer leaders on the issues and trends that matter most. Keep listening for an inside track on the people, IP policies, and politics changing our world.
Welcome to Autumn on the Air. Today, we're tackling one of the most critical yet underaddressed issues in our field, research misconduct and its devastating ripple effects throughout the entire innovation ecosystem. If you think research integrity is just an academic concern that doesn't affect technology transfer professionals, think again. What we're seeing today are cases where a single falsified image in a graduate dissertation can ultimately lead to hundreds of millions of dollars in losses, collapsed companies, and shattered trust in research enterprise. Our guest today witnessed these consequences firsthand and brings a unique dual perspective to this conversation. Michael Samardzija is a senior counsel at Womble Bond Dickinson, but his background spans both sides of the technology transfer equation. He holds a PhD in physiology and a master's degree in exercise physiology from Loma Linda University, along with a JD from the University of San Diego School of Law. Over his 23-year career, he served as Vice President of Research Affairs at Loma Linda University Health, where he established the N3A Business Incubator and held leadership roles at major law firms, including Dentons and Bracewell Giuliani. He's also served as Director of Intellectual Property at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, giving him an insider's view of the challenges that technology transfer offices face daily. Michael recently presented a compelling analysis he calls Research Misconduct's Butterfly Effects, examining how seemingly isolated instances of scientific misconduct create cascading consequences across the entire innovation landscape. Today, we'll explore these interconnections and what they mean for technology transfer professionals. Welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Lisa.
Well, I'm really excited to have you here, Michael, because this is a topic we have not touched on before in the podcast, research misconduct. And I think it's a fascinating topic, and maybe the best place to kick the podcast off is for you to explain to the audience, what is research misconduct?
Sure. So research misconduct is governed by laws that are promulgated by the administrative branch. And since I deal with mostly NIH, the Office of Research Integrity at the Department of Health and Human Services is responsible to oversee all research misconduct investigations. And usually it's one of the three deadly sins. Either it's fabrication, falsification, or plagiarism. And it needs to have been done either intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, and it has to be proven by preponderance of the evidence. Now, honest errors and differences of opinion are excluded from that. But usually these are all associated with publications. But as we know in the tech transfer area, a lot of the publications become patent applications and patents and licenses. And that's where the problem can occur.
Now, you gave a really fascinating presentation recently where you describe research misconduct's butterfly effects as small actions in research that can have massive downstream impacts for commercialization and innovation. Can you share an example illustrating this and why this is such a critical issue right now?
Sure. The problem is when there is research misconduct of an underlying publication for which a patent application was filed, well, the inventors have an obligation to the patent office of actually being very honest. And if there is research misconduct and it's willful by the inventors, then the problem is what they've submitted to the patent office can be deemed to be fraudulent, and in which case all of the patent is deemed unenforceable, because of that fraud. And that becomes a big issue potentially if you, as a tech transfer person, are trying to license that to a company.
Now, you've had an amazing career because you've both been in law as well as academia. And how has your own experience informed your views on risk management for TTOs when it comes to this whole idea of research integrity?
Well, the reason I think tech transfer offices need to think about that, because the knee-jerk reaction to this, and really, there is a huge increase in allegations of research misconduct. There is a huge increase of publications that have been retracted. So it's only a matter of time when this will affect a patent application. And I think the knee-jerk reaction from licensees is going to be to ask or require tech transfer offices to represent and warrant that the underlying patents is devoid of research misconduct. And I think being prepared for such is going to be important, because I don't think that any university wants to be in the position to actually make such a representation and warranty.
And then I don't even know how you do the due diligence to be able to make that rep and warranty.
Correct. Well, okay. So potentially, because the underlying regulation, at least from the Office of Research Integrity, which is Title 42 of the Code of Federal Regulation, Part 93, requires an institution to sequester all of the underlying data for that paper. And one of the things that perhaps tech transfer offices can do is collect all of the underlying data, make a copy of it, and then offer it to a licensee. Let them do a due diligence of it. And if there's any issue of research misconduct, well, then at that point, the university can handle that. But offer it to them to make that determination.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the only way that they're going to be able to manage this type of situation. Hopefully, it doesn't occur, but in the event there's a question, I think that's some great advice. And, you know, Michael, it was really interesting when I was doing my research for this podcast. I saw several studies that suggest that research fraud isn't just the product of lone actors, which is kind of scary. There's increasingly these organized networks, some of which are called paper mills or brokers, that are producing and distributing fraudulent science at scale, which is really disturbing. I know you saw a paper earlier this year published by Richardson et al. In PNAS that had to do with how fraud networks operate and evade detection. Talk to us a little bit about this paper and what some of the key takeaways were.
So this is sadly something that has been happening for a while. I think the issue is that you have individuals that are, you know, faculty members, even graduate students, that feel a pressure for having to publish in order for, you know, graduate students have to publish in order to graduate. Faculty members have to publish in order to submit a grant or to get a promotion. So there is a huge incentive to have to publish in order to move to the next level of where you're at. And I know I teach a course at one of the universities called Research Integrity, and one of my students discovered a paper that was published by a group of individuals, and then the very same paper published in another journal by an entirely different group of individuals.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
That's
wild. And so eventually she did the right thing. She contacted both journals. They made an investigation, and one of the papers was retracted because clearly only one group could have done the work. The other one could not. So I thought that was interesting. But yeah, I mean, there are issues with making the incentives so hard to basically have to publish in order to move forward. But also, I think there are, even countries where this is happening, where people are, and these publications that are, anyone now can publish anything. And so that's the problem, because you have these mills that all they do is they look for people to publish and they charge some fee. So for some fee, you can publish. Even there are individuals that are preparing manuscripts and paying, if you want to pay to be part of that manuscript, you can. It has become a whole wholesale industry. So there are good reasons to worry about this if you are at an academic institution.
Yeah, it sounds like it's really starting to run rampant. So I know there have been a lot of retractions lately. I've seen an article recently, I think it was in Science, that mentioned this. So beyond honest errors, what patterns are you seeing emerging in some of this large-scale misconduct? Things like journal hopping and manipulation of metrics. Are those the things you're type of seeing, or does it go even beyond that?
So journal hopping is normal. Right. If one journal, their requirements are a certain way, and then you go to another one, that isn't quite as bad. What is bad is in that process, errors can occur because there are requirements by each journal to provide figures, to provide images, and each one is different. And in that process, you may be drawing the wrong image, and errors can occur, and errors aren't good for science. They're not, certainly not good for the investigators who really didn't mean to make the errors, but those things occur. But beyond that, trying to get a data published that you made up or that you cherry-pick just because it tells a good story. Well, we know this has happened previously, and we have many high-profile cases that have been shown with some faculty members being basically let go because of that.
Now, it's interesting, India was in the news recently because they're imposing some strict punishments on scientists whose work results in multiple retractions. Do you think this is a sign that countries and institutions are starting to shift from maybe a soft to a harder approach towards research misconduct?
Yeah, I think it's even more poignant, actually. India is punishing the institutions or having the ones that are having too many faculty members that publish and their publications are retracted. If you have too many retractions, you're going to be punished. And I think that's fair enough, right? I mean, if it occurs on occasion, I get it. But if it's a wholesale happening at an institution, I think the institution needs to do a better job of policing that.
So what do you think that means for global tech transfer then?
As I said, I think for global tech, because right now we have a lot of collaborations.
Yes, a lot.
International collaborations. And I think it's important to be mindful that with that, you have a lot of risks because you are aware of your pressures and your circumstances, but you are not aware of what those are somewhere else. And the farther away they are, the higher potentially those risks are. So by collaborating, there is a lot of cachet, a lot of value in having these international collaborations, but at the same time, a lot of risks.
Now, I want to turn to a real life example of some research misconduct and really how it led to some severe legal, financial, and reputational consequences. So I know Athira Pharma was in the news earlier this year for research misconduct. Walk us through that case, you know, what the misconduct was and how that all unfolded.
Sure. So it's interesting because up to that case, when I was telling these are some issues that can occur, and I was telling people of these profound issues that can occur, it was all from a theoretical level. And then all of a sudden, this case occurred, and I'm like, aha, there you go. So I felt a little vindicated. So two faculty members at Washington State University discovered how a compound they called dihexa actually had some really positive results as far as reversing dementia. So they created a startup company that eventually they called M3 Biotechnology. And then they had a graduate student that worked on this molecule. And when she graduated, she joined M3 Biotechnology. And eventually she joined as the VP of research, but then within a few years, she became the CEO of the company. And during this process, they discovered that really dihexa by itself is not as good because you can't really deliver it that way. So they created a prodrug of dihexa, and they filed a patent on the prodrug. And the prodrug proved to be really, really fascinating in animal studies. And so they started to look at, getting money for conducting clinical trials. In the process, they also changed their name from M3 Biotechnologies to Athira Pharma. And the graduate student happened to be a really, really good, the former graduate student became a really, really good CEO. She raised a lot of funds initially from the state of Washington. Then she began to file grant applications to the National Institute of Aging and eventually received $15.2 million from the NIA to actually do a phase one clinical study. And then the FDA approved the IND for that, and they started this phase one study. The problem is during the early submission of a grant, one of the reviewers discovered some of the underlying publications on which the grant application relied on. He noticed that there was some issues with several images, and he mentioned that this could be a result of research misconduct. To his credit, he told the NIH, he told Athira, and he told Washington State University where those publications originated from. And most of those publications were the result of the two faculty members and the former graduate student while they were at Washington State University. And there were issues that if you looked at it, you would see splicing of some of the gels. You know, it looked unnatural as though somebody cut and pasted kind of different things on the image. And to their credit, the two faculty members informed the chair, their chair at Washington State University, and the board chair at Athira. And the former graduate student even admitted to embellishing the images. She claimed that all of the data was untarnished. You know, she just wanted to make the images a little better. And then nothing happened. It's like all crickets. And then they continued to raise a tremendous amount of money. They started a phase 2-3 clinical trial, closed $85 million in phase B financing, and then even did an IPO, got about $186 million in the first IPO, followed by $22 million, followed by $90 million. So if you keep track, it's over $400 million that was raised by this former graduate student. Amazing CEO. My goodness, what an ability to raise money. As soon as the IPO occurred, the reviewer of that grant initially figured out, okay, well, no one's doing their job. He then filed a key TAM suit. So he filed a False Claims Act suit in court, and that allows whistleblowers, people who discovered these issues, to file to get money back for these issues. And it took the Department of Justice 5 extensions of time, because clearly they don't have PhDs on board, until they figured out, yeah, we're joining this. And there were 6 publications that were at issue, and all of them really issues that I was telling you about. And then eventually, when that occurred, when that was filed, at that point, the company issued a press release saying that the former graduate student was placed on temporary leave pending investigation. And on that day, the share fell, the price, the stock shares, the price fell nearly 40% of its original price. So it was a devastating hit for the company. Eventually, the False Claims Act suit was settled for a little over $4 million, and the whistleblower received 5% of that. 5% of that, yes. And then Athira also had to agree to cooperate fully with the department's investigation, not limiting to the former CEO, because clearly they saw it as if she had in fact conducted any fraud, they want to have the ability to go after her later on. But that wasn't the end of it. Shareholders filed a shareholder derivative.
They always do afterwards.
Derivative class action suit. That's right, exactly. Because the prospectus that they received didn't have this in there. Do you understand? The prospectus, they claim, didn't have this in there.
I wonder why.
The chair of the company knew about this. The two founders knew about this way, way long ago, and they didn't put this in the prospectus. You know, that was kind of interesting.
That's really rather humorous in a sad way when you think about it.
So 4 out of the 6 publications were from the Journal of Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics. That journal issued notices of concern. And then, of course, they contacted the authors and Washington State University. Washington State University removed the former graduate student's dissertation from its archive and started an inquiry. Then that eventually became an investigation. And my understanding is that investigation has completed, but the former graduate student is now appealing that decision. So we'll find out what will happen. Ultimately, the former graduate student resigned her position. She received about $510,000 and was able to retain her stock options. The company basically said that, well, all of the issues were with Dihexa. The drug, ATH-1017, just for the sake of clarity, that's the prodrug, they're saying has nothing to do with Dihexa. Now, of course, the prodrug, once it's cleaved, becomes dihexa in the body. So I'm not sure how they can say that with a straight face, but as we know, attorneys make these claims quite a bit. And so ultimately, the price fell down even more. Right now, it's trading at under 25 cents a share.
I looked today. Yeah, that's what I saw too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, Athira was valued at $670 million in 2020. That's the high. And now, as of January of 2025, it was at $25 million, their market cap. So it just goes to show you how incredibly powerful this can be to kind of hurt a company. And you see, the effects are far beyond the university in this case.
Yeah, absolutely incredible story. And given that we now have a real world example where research misconduct has had really far reaching consequences, what lessons do you think TTO should draw about due diligence, whistleblowing, and what can go wrong if integrity issues go undressed for a long period of time?
So from a due diligence perspective, I don't know that tech transfer offices have the bandwidth and maybe even the expertise to conduct due diligence, right? You need imaging experts, you need experts in the field to actually say that whether this, what they've conducted is right or wrong. Did they cherry pick data or not? Did they wholesale make it up or not? Are any of the images altered or not? Or are they done to beautify? At some point, I think the scientific community needs to have better standards. That would be really good for all of us to understand what is acceptable to alter in an image and what is not acceptable. I think that would be helpful. But I think from a tech transfer office, the best they can do is try to get copies of all of the data, all of the original data, and have it sequestered somewhere and have it at the ready in case anyone wants to actually conduct an investigation or anyone requests for an institution to actually represent and warrants that this is devoid of any research misconduct. But I think tech transfer offices should really get ready with individuals making those requests for license agreements.
Now, you mentioned about getting the data and having it available. Do you suggest they do that at the beginning when they get a disclosure or if it's something that goes to a patent application, when do you think is the best time period for them to do that? And do they do it every case? Because I could see where that would add another administrative burden to people who are already overwhelmed.
I think the only time I would do it is if the licensee makes a request to rep and warranty. And then you could offer, look, I'm not going to represent and warrant, but I will give you access to all of the data and you can conduct your own investigation and make a determination whether or not research misconduct occurred. But I'm not going to represent and warrant that. You know, we don't have the bandwidth or the money to pay for someone to do all of that. I think that's a fair pushback from any tech transfer office.
Now, at the beginning, you mentioned patent litigation and unenforceability of a patent. Have you seen any efforts to challenge any IP based on integrity issues in underlying science, or are we still waiting for that case to come?
Yeah, I think we're still waiting for that.
I thought so, yeah.
And I think that this can also be a tool in patent prosecution, right? So if a prior art, paper or published patent application is basically raised by the examiner against you, it may be worth your while to see if the underlying paper was actually retracted. And then you can bring that up to the examiner that no one would rely on a retracted paper. And you have a good reason. Now, likewise, in any patent litigation, this can be a tool also for any prior art that is raised against you, but understand it can also be a tool against the patent that you are asserting or your licensee is asserting.
Yeah, definitely a double-edged sword there. You need to be careful and do your own due diligence before you start to yield that sword.
That's right.
So, Michael, are there some practical steps you think TTO should adopt to reduce exposure from disclosure forms to licensing agreements to collaborations with research integrity officers, things like that?
Well, I think that especially if you are dealing with technology that is co-invented between institutions, you have to understand that the best you can do is provide data that your institution has. Any data that's conducted or collected elsewhere, it's hard for you to do anything with that. The other thing I think that it's hard because if there are findings of research misconduct, it's going to affect your campus, it's going to affect what you do. So if you take the lead, I think also including in interinstitutional agreements, that the other side is going to collect all of the data and give you copies of, because they can't give you the originals, but give you copies of all of the underlying data if you request it at no cost to you. I think that would be a good way to help protect you, because at the very least, you have that to provide to a potential licensee as well.
Do you have any thoughts, given the increase in research misconduct that we're seeing, particularly all these retractions, that we need some type of new framework for accountability and oversight? And if so, who do you think should lead those changes?
So that's an age-old debate. Because right now, the Office of Research Integrity at the Department of Health and Human Services really empowers the institutions to conduct the research misconduct investigations. There are discussions that perhaps that should be done by a different body altogether, that the institution should be removed from that calculus. But I'm not sure how to do that really effectively if that is the case. So that is going to be a difficult part. Although perhaps with the decrease in funding, there's going to be less of that, since I don't know that there's going to be an increase in publications because there's going to be decrease in funding. So I'm not sure how that will affect things in the future.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Does decreases in funding then lead to increases in misconduct because everybody's trying, you know, there's a smaller pot of money to go for that people are going to be more motivated to commit misconduct? I don't know. It's going to be fascinating to see.
And more desperate. Yeah,
definitely more desperate right now. So, Michael, for TTO directors and their staff who might be listening today, do you have some go-to recommendations to help their institutions prevent, detect, and respond to research misconduct risk that's maybe realistic and efficient?
Well, I think that, you know, you need to work, you know, really closely with your research integrity offices so that you are at least aware of any research misconduct issues or findings. The investigations need to be kept in confidence. So you will not be informed if there is allegation, if there are inquiries, if there are investigations. You won't be informed of that because the law and the policies require for that to occur in confidence. But once that comes out, any findings do come out and there's determinations, you need to be ready at the very, you know, you need to be ready very quickly to inform the potential licensee. And then, you know, you need to deal with the after effects. So having a playbook so that you know what your responses should be, how are you going to respond? I think those are really, really important. Be also prepared that potential licensees will tell you that, hey, at the very least, the money that you are supposed to share with the inventors should be placed in a trust fund. And only only provided to them at the termination of the license, because there is an unjust enrichment, especially if they're found to have committed fraud. So that may be another way that potential licensees will ask for you just to mitigate their losses in the event of fraud. You also have some fraud language in license agreement that you may want to review very carefully, because that section may be used to actually not only terminate the agreement, but then seek damages. So keep in mind that fraud language in your license agreement needs to be really carefully reviewed in light of these increases in research misconduct that are occurring.
I know, Michael, this has been a really fascinating conversation. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you if you have any final thoughts on how TTO professionals, particularly those who may be new to the field, can help navigate and fix this problem, if there is even a fix, and maybe avoid contributing to it unknowingly.
Well, I don't know that they can, you know, they wouldn't be involved with a data capture. They wouldn't be involved with a publication or the analysis. So I don't know that they would contribute to that. But if there are even a suspicion of data that is falsified or fabricated or plagiarized, contact your research integrity office right away. It is better for the university to self-report issues rather than have that provided by a third party. This way, the institution does the right thing, and that helps the institution's reputation a lot more than if a third party were to bring that up.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for sharing all your expertise today. This has been a fascinating conversation on research misconduct. I'm sure listeners are going to have questions for you. Where can they reach you?
Well, I work at a law firm called Womble Bond Dickinson, and I work out of the Irvine office. So if they go on the website, they will be able to see me there, and I'll be glad to talk to them.
Well, thank you so much again, Michael. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Michael, for taking time to share your expertise and insights with us today. As Michael mentioned, if you're interested in learning more about protecting your institution from research misconduct risks, or if you have a specific question about the legal implications we discussed, reach out to Michael at Womble Bond Dickinson. That's all for today's episode of Autumn on the Air. Remember to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and join us next week for another conversation about the people and issues shaping research commercialization. Until then, keep innovating, but do it with integrity.
Thanks for listening to Autumn on the Air with Lisa Mueller. Get social with us and share your thoughts. You can tweet us at AUTM or visit us online at AUTM.net. We'll be back next week on the air. Be sure to join us.